Last Sunday morning, we studied about Jesus Christ and the Sabbath, particularly focusing on the aspect of the Sabbath law that was in effect. Of course, that law was in effect when Christ was on the earth. He was subject to the law of Moses, being an Israelite. And so Jesus submitted to the Sabbath law, that is, he kept God's law, but he did not submit to the misunderstandings and the misapplications of God's law that were by the leaders of the Jews during that time. And so those who were establishing their own laws for the Sabbath day that God had not established, Jesus did not submit to or follow those things. We also saw that Jesus taught that what the actual purpose of the Sabbath was, and we looked at the Old Testament scriptures that showed its purpose and the truth of it, that it was a day for man to cease from his own labors or his own works and from doing his own pleasure, but it was a day that was reserved for doing the Lord's work. And so, as Jesus said in Matthew 12 and verse 12, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath day, to do good works. And so when they were condemning Jesus and his disciples for not submitting to their laws, Jesus exposed their hypocrisy and the falsehood of their teachings and establishing their own doctrine about the Sabbath, that was not in accordance with God's teachings at all. So we want to pick up from there this morning as we continue that study of Christ and the Sabbath. What we want to do this morning is, first of all, look at another aspect of Jesus' work on the Sabbath day, or his dealing with the Sabbath law, and that is that he did do miraculous works on the Sabbath day. That was something that brought him into major conflict with the Pharisees, as again, they had their own doctrines about the Sabbath that God didn't establish, and by their understanding, doing a miracle was doing work, and all work was forbidden on the Sabbath day by their understanding. They did not discern that the Lord had reserved that day for doing the Lord's will, not their own, and to do good works was not only not a violation of the Sabbath, it was actually the very purpose of it. So they completely misunderstood what that day was for. And so they condemned Jesus for the miracles that he did on the Sabbath day. But once again, this will illustrate how Jesus rejected man's laws for that day as he submitted to God's law for that day. And then we want to conclude our study this morning looking at how that the laws of the Sabbath were taken away, were removed when Jesus was crucified, and that is not incorporated into the New Testament. So we're no longer under the Sabbath laws today. All right, so Jesus and his works on the Sabbath, as far as miracles were concerned, we have a number of examples of it. The first one we want to see is in John chapter 5. John chapter 5, this was early in Christ's ministry on the earth, but he was in Jerusalem on the Feast of the Jews, it says in verse 1. And it says in verse 2 that there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? The impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool, but while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Jesus saith unto him, Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, and took up his bed, and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, It is the Sabbath day, it is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. Now Jesus is the one that just told him to do that, to take up his bed and walk. Well, he had the bed there because that's where he spent 38 years lying by that water. So Jesus had healed him now and instructed him he could go home and take his things, and he didn't have to stay there anymore. So now after being cured of an ailment that had plagued him being unable to walk for 38 years, you wonder how many steps he actually took before he was roundly condemned by these Pharisees, because he happens to be carrying the bedding that he had by that pool. So here he's condemned for that. Of course, this again was not a violation of God's law for the Sabbath. He wasn't doing his own work and trying to accomplish his own pleasure on that day when he's walking home with his things, having been healed by Christ. But they condemned him for it anyway. And so in verse 11 it says, he answered them, "He that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk." So he was letting it be known that he was merely doing what he was instructed to do, and not just by anybody, but by somebody who clearly had the power of God, who had healed him of that infirmity that he had, who had done that miracle. So someone who had performed a great miracle had told him to do what he was doing. And so they asked him in verse 12, what man is that which said unto thee, take up thy bed and walk? And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. Well, is there anything worse than not being able to walk for 38 years? Yes. Losing one's soul in eternity is far, far worse. And so Jesus was warning him of the consequences of sin as he was teaching him. What was he more concerned about, this man's legs or his soul? Clearly he was most concerned about his soul. But he healed his problem with his legs, but he then taught him what he needed to hear as far as how to live. And so in verse 15, the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. So now he knew who it was, and he identified him. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. Well, is it okay to kill somebody on the Sabbath? I guess that was maybe not part of their particular doctrine. Somehow that work seems to have been legal according to their understanding. But anyway, we can see the hypocrisy at work here, but their reason for wanting to kill Jesus was because he had done a miracle on the Sabbath day which violated their law, not God's, theirs. But Jesus answered them, my Father worketh hitherto and I work. So he was letting them know that God works and that he also was working, but he was working the Father's works. Now, is that acceptable on the Sabbath day? I mean, that was the very purpose of it. Which is what he's pointing out again. In verse 18, therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. So here was one of these occasions, and this was earlier in his ministry, in Jerusalem, where he angered the leaders of the Jews because he had done a miraculous work on the Sabbath day. Now a couple of chapters later in John chapter 7, verses 19 and 24, here we go again. In this case, Jesus is referring to this particular incident that we saw in chapter 5, but he's back there again. And in verse 19, Jesus asked, did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keepeth the law? Why go you about to kill me? Now, what did we just read in chapter 5? What were they seeking to do? To kill him. Now, verse 20, the people answered and said, thou hast a devil, who goeth about to kill thee? Well, is it okay to lie on the Sabbath day? I mean, they're telling a blatant falsehood. They were seeking to kill him. Why are they denying that truth? And so Jesus was asking them, why were they doing that when they were professing to follow Moses, but they weren't keeping Moses' law? See, they weren't following what God said, but they were condemning Jesus for not following what they were saying. In verse 22, he said, Moses therefore gave unto you circumcision, not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers, and yet ye on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. If a man on the Sabbath day receive circumcision, that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? Judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. So there he was saying what they needed to hear. They were not judging righteously. And so to circumcise someone on the Sabbath day, which of course is doing a damage to the flesh, but yet we know, of course, that was God's commandment, and so that was That was legal. That was something they did. If the eighth day after birth happened to be on the Sabbath day, if they had been born on a Friday, they got circumcised on Saturday, on the Sabbath day. But Jesus, on the Sabbath day, had made someone whole, had done a miracle. And they're going to condemn him for that? Well, they were being hypocrites. And they were not judging righteously. So, and then, of course, they're lying about their desire and their plans to try to kill him. But anyway, this is, again, these leaders of the Jews, and not understanding at all what God had taught concerning the Sabbath. And they were wrongly condemning Jesus for what he had done. Now in chapter 9 here in the Gospel of John, in verse 1, we're reading in verse 5 of someone who had not walked in 38 years. Now we're going to be reading about a man who had never seen in his life. He was born blind. It says in verse 1 of John 9, "And as Jesus passed by, saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him." Now Jesus was giving the actual reason why the man had been born blind. And what was it? So that God's works would be revealed in him. Does that mean that God had actually caused this man to be born blind with the intent, with the purpose that one day that God's own son would be doing a miracle to give him his sight? I mean, that's what Jesus was saying. This was within God's plans. Once again, illustrates how God knows so much more than we do, and we can look at things without the knowledge that God has and not understand a situation. Why was this man born blind? That was the question they were asking. It's a question pretty much any of us might ask. And what would be God's reason for that? Well, here we see God had a very good reason for it. Now, that reason had been hidden from everyone up until this moment, but yet God had a very good reason for why he had made that man to be born blind. But God has a good reason for all the things that he does, even if we don't know what those reasons are. We have to trust him. But Jesus explained that was the reason, so that these works of God would be manifest in him. Now notice how he phrased that. Whose work? These works of God. So this was going to be the Lord's work being done to heal him. So was the Sabbath a day in which the works of God were forbidden? Or was that a day in which expressly the works of God were supposed to be done, exclusive to all other works, that is, man's own works? And that was its purpose. So in verse 4, he said, "I must works the works of him that sent me." It was not even an option. Jesus said, "I must do his works, the one who sent me." He had to do God's work. And did it matter what day it was? It was every day that Jesus would do that. But certainly on the Sabbath day, this was a day to do God's work, and that's what Jesus was going to do. So here he's really in advance now giving the justification, the reason why it was not only okay, but it was very much exactly what he should have been doing to do this miracle on the Sabbath day. Jesus said, "The night cometh," he says, "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay and said unto him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is by interpretation sent. He went his way therefore and washed and came seeing. The neighbors therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind, said, "Is not this he that sat and begged?" Some said, "This is he." Others said, "He is like him." But he said, "I am he." Therefore said they unto him, "How were thine eyes open?" He answered and said, "A man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed mine eyes and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed and I received sight." Then said they unto him, "Where is he?" He said, "I know not." They brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. See, there's where the problem's going to come in. Up until that verse 14, as we're reading 1 through 13, is there anything there that should have upset anybody? Now, of course not. Of course, even with verse 14, that still shouldn't have upset anybody. But it is going to very much upset these Pharisees again that Jesus has done a miracle on the Sabbath day. They end up bringing in his parents to question them to verify that this really was a man who had been born blind, because they're doubting it until his own parents say, "Yes, this is our son and he was born blind." So when they can no longer gainsay the fact that a miracle was done, they can't dispute that, then they go after the man himself who had been made blind. Just like they condemned the poor man who had been healed and was able to walk in chapter 5. Now they're going to condemn this man who had been born blind. So here on the Sabbath day, somebody who's walking for the first time in 38 years, the first thing that happens is he gets condemned for carrying his bed. And here's a man who's never seen anything in his life. And right here on that very day, a short time after he's able to see for the first time ever, he's going to be condemned and then cast out of the synagogue. They're going to be removing their fellowship from him because he will not condemn Jesus, but in fact exposes the falsehood of their doctrine. He has better sight than they do, and of course in the spiritual sense. But in verse 24, they called again the man that was blind and said to him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." Why are they condemning him as a sinner? Because he healed on the Sabbath day. And in verse 25, he answered and said, "Whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." Then said they to him again, "What did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you did not hear. Wherefore would you hear it again? Will you be also be his disciples?" So he understood they were not interested in listening, and they were not going to follow him no matter what he said. He perceived that very well. And then they answered that in verse 28, reviling him. He said, "Thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples." So they're condemning him and accusing him of following Christ, and which they're saying was contrary to being able to follow Moses. Of course, that was very wrong. In verse 29, "We know that God spake to Moses. As for this fellow, we know not from whence he is." Now, here's a question. How did they know that God spoke to Moses? How did anybody know that that was true? That is true. God did speak to Moses. Why did they believe that? I mean, you can go back to the fourth chapter of the book of Exodus where that very issue was handled, because Moses himself said, "When I go to them and say the Lord's appeared to me, they will say he has not appeared to thee." And what was done at that time on that day to cause all the people in Israel to believe that God had appeared to Moses and had indeed spoken to him? He was given miracles, miraculous signs, three of them that day. And when he performed those miracles before the people, it says they believed and they bowed their heads in worship. Of course, then there were many more miracles that God did by his hand. But that's what convinced the Jews to believe that God had spoken to Moses. It was the miracles that were done, God bearing witness to Moses. Well, that being the very reason why they would know that God had spoken to Moses, here's a miracle that's done on this day, and the man himself is going to point out that such has never been heard of before. When in history had somebody who had been born blind been given their sight? And instead of recognizing that and saying, "Well, this obviously, this is the power of God, and God is with this man, and God must be speaking to this man, and we better listen to what God has said through him, or what God is saying through him." Instead, they say, we don't know where he's from. And so then the man who has been healed of his blindness answered and said, verse 30, "Why, herein is a marvelous thing, that you know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and doeth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing." Now, was he right or was he wrong in that? So they're accusing Jesus of being a sinner. And what is he saying? I don't see how that could be possible. God's not going to be with a sinner like God is obviously with this man. And if he were not of God, he could do nothing. And that is very true. And so their response to that in verse 34, they answered and said to him, "Thou wast altogether born in sins, and dost thou teach us?" And they cast him out. So they rejected it, and he's thrown out. Of course, he believes in Christ. That's what happens next. Jesus tells him, one of the rare times where Jesus plainly told somebody, "I am the Son of God." And he told that man. That man believed and followed Christ. So there was a very, that was a wonderful day for this man, not just for him physically, but especially for him spiritually. But here the Jews were condemning him again because he had healed on the Sabbath day. In Luke chapter 13, another example of this, Luke chapter 13, verses 10 through 17, In this case, Jesus healed a woman who had an infirmity in her back for 18 years. I mean, think of how long these people have been suffering. And then Jesus is showing compassion and mercy and doing God's work on the Sabbath day to relieve these people of misery. And not only that, but of course, as a demonstration of God's power that he had indeed sent Christ. So all of this was in accordance with the work of God, with his will. And in Luke chapter 13, they're going to condemn him for it, but he's going to shame them for their hypocrisy and their condemnation of him for healing this woman on the Sabbath day. Luke 13, 10 to 17. It says, he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bowed together and could in no wise lift up herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said unto her, Woman, thou art loosed from thine infirmity. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. And the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day, and said unto the people, There are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them therefore come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day. Then the Lord then answered him and said, Thou hypocrite! Doth not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and lead him away to watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan hath bound, lo, these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? And when he had said these things, all his adversaries were ashamed, and all the people rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. So at least here were some people that considered what he said and were ashamed of their condemnation of him on the Sabbath day. What he said was right. He exposed their own hypocrisy. They would show compassion on a beast on the Sabbath day. But here was a woman that was a daughter of Abraham, and they're going to show her no compassion. They could not discern that this was the Lord's work and the right thing to do. So he was showing again what the Sabbath purpose really was. The very next chapter, Luke 14, in this case, he's going to act preemptively to silence them before he even does the miracle on the Sabbath day. He obviously has quite a bit of experience with them and their reaction to the miracles that he did on the Sabbath. Luke 14, 1 to 6, it says, It came to pass as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. And behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? So now he's asking them the question. He's going to get them to declare themselves, but of course they won't do it. In verse 4, they held their peace. And he took him and healed him and let him go, and answered them, saying, Which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him again to these things. So once more, he shows their own hypocrisy. They would rescue an animal. They would show that kind of compassion on an animal on the Sabbath day. That would be okay by their own doctrine. But here to show compassion on a human, one of their own brothers or sisters, and that would be wrong. So he silenced them beforehand in this case. In Matthew chapter 12, and we read last week the first part of this chapter when they condemned Christ and his disciples for plucking grain on the Sabbath day, when they were going forth, when they were in need and in the middle of doing the Lord's work, teaching and preaching his word, and for them to then take food to eat for themselves, to have the strength to do the Lord's work, not to pick food or pick grain so they could go sell it and make money doing their own work. They were doing this strictly to serve the Lord and do his work. They wrongly condemned his disciples for that. But right after that, here in Matthew chapter 12, 9 to 14, it says, When he was departed thence, he went into their synagogue, and behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. And they asked him, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days, that they might accuse him? And he said unto them, What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift him out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. Then said he to the man, Stretch forth thine hand. And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole, like as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. So here he healed this man. They're trying to kill him again. But he was showing them that what he was doing was the right thing to do. It was an acceptable work because it was God's work. Now, in all these cases, what is the ultimate proof that they were wrong? When they were saying that it was a sin to do this kind of work on the Sabbath day, a miraculous work. Jesus said, it is not a sin. In fact, it is right because it is God's work. They say, no, this is not right. Well, what's the proof that Jesus was right and they were wrong? What's the ultimate proof? I mean, they both can't be right. How do we know who was right? What happened when Jesus attempted all those miracles? They were done. If Jesus were wrong, if these Pharisees were correct, that was a sin to do a miracle on the Sabbath day. If Jesus had tried to do it and it was going to be something that transgressed God's law, what would have happened when Jesus attempted to do the miracle? It would have failed. I mean, God was not going to bear witness to Christ if he was speaking falsely. And he's saying doing God's work, the Father's work on the Sabbath day is right. And God bears witness to Christ giving the proof by the miracle that what Jesus was saying was in fact right. And so this proved them to be wrong and proved their doctrine about the Sabbath day to be false. And of course they didn't accept it as they then attempted to once again kill Christ and took counsel to do that when he had done a good work and had proven them to be wrong. But the proof was in the miracle the miracles themselves that were accomplished on the Sabbath days. If Jesus were wrong, the miracles would not have been done. As that blind man himself said, if God were not with him, he could do nothing. It was only by God's power that those miracles were done. So Jesus proved his teaching was right that said that it was right to do God's work on the Sabbath day. Not man's own work, but God's work. But when Jesus instituted the New Testament, as he lived and taught those things that were his everlasting covenant, that law that we're under, the law of Christ, the New Testament, the Sabbath and its laws are not included in the New Testament. Now in Matthew chapter 5, we'll remind ourselves of what Jesus said about the law of Moses and every part of it, even every jot and tittle in that law. Matthew 5, 17 to 19, he said, "Think not that I'm come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So Jesus didn't come to destroy the law of Moses. He came to fulfill it. But when it was fulfilled, what was going to happen to it? When it was fulfilled, now Jesus didn't say not a jot nor tittle will ever pass from this law, ever. He said till it was all fulfilled, and that's what he came to do. The implication was, what he was teaching there was that when it was fulfilled, when Jesus fulfilled all of it, he was going to take it out of the way. That was what the intention was from the beginning. God had never intended for the law of Moses to be the permanent law for all of mankind. And that was for Israel, and it served as a shadow for the coming of Christ and the establishment of his covenant, that everlasting covenant. So in Matthew chapter 17, Jesus was transfigured on the mount, the Father spoke from heaven and made it clear that Jesus and his words would be the ones that all men were to be listening to from then on, that he was not merely on equal plane with Moses and the prophets, that is with the old covenant, but that he was instituting a new covenant that would supplant it, and that's what we need to listen to and follow today. Matthew 17, 1 to 5, it says, "After 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth him up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto him Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. Now, as Peter and James and John saw Jesus and they saw Moses and Elijah talking with him, it doesn't tell us how they were able to identify them and know that's who they were, but obviously, by some means, they were told who they were. And so they knew that was Moses and Elijah there with Christ. What an amazing thing. What an amazing thing their eyes had the opportunity to behold on that day. And as Peter said, it was good for them to be there. They got to see Moses and Elijah talking with Christ. And then Peter, with his understanding, says, well, let us build three tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses and Elijah. Now, that was paying him the highest compliment, really, a Jew could pay him, putting him on equal plane with Moses and the prophets. I mean, how much greater could you be for someone of Israel? But what did the Father say? Was Jesus equal with Moses and the prophets? Or did he say, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased, hear you him? There was, Jesus was in the process of revealing his covenant that was soon going to be in effect that would supplant Moses and the prophets. They would no longer be following that. They would now be following Jesus Christ, God's Son. That's who we're following today. Not anymore are we to follow Moses and the prophets in terms of our of a law, a religious law. Now, are we to listen to, should we study the words of Moses and the prophets in the Old Testament to learn from the examples, to learn the principles, to learn about God and His ways and His judgments? Yes. And we're commanded to do that. But that leads us to, it's our schoolmaster, it leads us to the salvation that is in Christ Jesus. As a law, we're only to follow Christ and hear Him as our lawgiver. And in Matthew 28 and verse 18, Jesus said, all authority, that all power that is authority, is given unto me in heaven and in earth. So He possesses all authority, and by His authority, of course, He has given us the new and everlasting covenant, which has taken the old covenant, out of the way. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 8, in which He's fulfilling a prophecy that Jeremiah himself gave, a prophecy that said that the old covenant would be done away and that God was going to establish a new one through His Son. Hebrews chapter 8 is going to be quoting from Jeremiah chapter 31, 31 to 34, if you want the original text. But we'll be reading what it says here in Hebrews 8, beginning in verse 6. But now hath He obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also He is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, He saith, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the hand of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that He saith a new covenant, He hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. And the very fact that He used that term, new covenant, implied, taught that the one that preceded it would become old and would be done away. And it was ready to vanish away because Jesus had established His covenant. And let's turn to Colossians chapter 2 and see how He clearly states in this passage in Colossians 2 that the old covenant was done away when Christ was crucified. And He's even going to specifically mention the Sabbath laws when, as an example, that law as an example of one of those things that we're no longer under and that we can no longer be judged or condemned for not following. Colossians chapter 2, starting in verse 10, He says, "And ye are complete in Him, which is the head of all principality and power, in whom also ye are circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, and putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, buried with Him in baptism, wherein also ye are risen with Him through the faith of the operation of God, who hath raised Him from the dead. And you being dead in your sins, and the uncircumcision of your flesh, hath He quickened together with Him, having forgiven you all trespasses." Now there he speaks of the circumcision of Christ. We're no longer under the physical circumcision of the law of Moses, that token of that covenant. What is the token of the covenant? What will bring someone into the new covenant? Well, circumcision is what made somebody a part of the old covenant. Well, the spiritual circumcision, the circumcision of Christ, which is the cutting off of the body of sin, at which time we are buried with him in baptism. So baptism, which is a baptism into Christ's death with repentance coming before it, the crucifixion of the old man, that cutting off of the body of sin, then be buried with Christ, then to be raised to walk with him in newness of life. Well, there we see how one comes to be a part of the new covenant, the everlasting covenant, how one becomes a Christian. And so he's starting from that point. And then in verse 14, what did Christ do in addition to instituting his own circumcision, that spiritual circumcision, the cutting off of the body of sin as we're buried with him in baptism and obtained that forgiveness of sins? He says in verse 14, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. So what happened to the ordinances, the laws of the old covenant? They did vanish away. He fulfilled it all, and it was then taken out of the way. It was nailed to his cross. So are we under that anymore? No, we're not. In verse 15, he says, and having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. Now look at verse 16. He says, let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of a holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath. Now those are some particular examples of some of the laws of the Old Testament that have been taken out of the way. And so we're no longer to be judged by those laws because we're not under them. Now he mentions the new moon, he mentions those feast days, the dietary laws and all that. Are we restricted? Well, we can't eat this because it's unclean. Those kinds of things today under Christ? No, those dietary laws were taken out of the way. Those special feast days and holy days, that was all taken out of the way. Do we observe the Feast of Tabernacles? Do we observe the Feast of the Passover? Do we observe Pentecost? I mean, those were the feast days that the Jews had, and we don't observe the new moons and those other holy days. But what else is mentioned specifically there in verse 16, the last thing there? The Sabbath. So he uses that as one of the examples of those laws that were taken out of the way. We're no longer under it, therefore we no longer can be judged by those laws. Those are not in effect for us anymore. So the Sabbath is not a part of the law of Christ. That was part of the old covenant. That was the seventh day. Now, which is the day under Christ, which is the day that is the special day for us? Special in that the Lord has told us, given us particular commandments we are to do on that day and that day only. And that's the first day of the week. So that is the day that we come together like we are right now. That's the day we take of the Lord's Supper, Acts 20 and verse 7. That's the day in which we lay by in stores God has prospered us, 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2. That is the day that we assemble together and do these things that we're doing right now, that we have done this morning. Because this is the first day of the week, the Lord's Day. This is the first day, not the seventh. We're no longer under the laws for the Sabbath, the seventh day. That's been taken out of the way. Now, we'll also see that what the Lord tells us in regard to the Lord's Day, the first day of the week, we don't have any of those laws that were part of the law of Moses for the seventh day, the Sabbath. He doesn't transition those over. We have something completely different that we're under with Christ. And so we're not under the Sabbath law anymore. Well, what about those who say, well, we're going to treat Sunday as the Christian Sabbath? And you'll hear that term even, the Christian Sabbath. Well, that's really actually a contradiction in terms, an oxymoron. I mean, the Christian Sabbath, that would be the seventh day for Christians. Well, we don't have that taught anywhere. Jesus was raised on the first day of the week, on Sunday. That's the day that is called the Lord's Day. That's the day that we've been commanded to come together to remember his death and partaking of the Lord's Supper and to lay by in stores God has prospered us. We're not told anything about this day being a Sabbath. I mean, how can the first day be the seventh day? I mean, that just makes no sense. It's impossible. And so that very term itself, it makes no sense. But if we look at Galatians 5, verses 1 through 4, he lets us know that any of these laws that were part of the law of Moses that are not included in the New Testament, because again, we do recognize that there were many laws that were in the Old Testament that have been carried over and are repeated in the New Testament included there. In fact, at least in some form, 9 of the 10 commandments are. And we keep those because they are part of the law of Christ. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not covet. Those are part of the law of Christ, and that's why we keep them, not because they were in the law of Moses as part of the 10 commandments. But there is that one law of the 10 commandments that is not included in the New Testament at all, and that is the Sabbath. And we just saw what Colossians 2 and verse 16 said about that. Well, here, let's look at what Galatians 5, 1 to 4 says about all those laws that were under Moses that are no longer in effect for us today as for Christians. Galatians 5, 1 to 4, he says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Behold, I, Paul, say unto you that if you be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. For I testify again to every man that is circumcised that he is a debtor to do the whole law. Christ has become of none effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, you are fallen from grace." Speaking there about the law of Moses. Circumcision he mentions, but the same principle applies to the Sabbath, as we just saw in Colossians 2:16. And what does he say about any of those laws? If you choose one of those laws that were under the Old Testament and decide, well, that one I'm going to bring over. God didn't bring it over, but I'm going to do it. If you decide to bring one over, what does he say you're indebted to do in verse 3? You can't just bring one over. God didn't bring them over. If God didn't bring them over, if he did, of course, then they're part of the new covenant. But if God didn't bring it over from the old into the new, then he says, leave that alone. Don't do it. Don't follow it. But if you're going to insist on doing it anyway, what does he say we're a debtor to do? He says, then you got to do all of them. You can't just take one. Then you got to bring the whole bit. So if you bring circumcision, or if you bring tithing, or if you bring the Sabbath, or any of those, you got to bring all of it. That includes all the dietary laws. That includes all the animal sacrifices. That includes all the feast days. That includes everything. You can't pick and choose. It's not a la carte. You either have to leave it all or you have to take it all. Of course, the problem with taking it all is what? He says, then we're cut off from Christ. He's become of none effect to us. And if you went back to the third chapter, we would see there how all those that are under it are cursed by it, because that very law curses anyone who doesn't keep every part of it. So then we're bringing ourselves under a curse and nullifying our own salvation by Christ. So we'll lose our souls for it. So is there anybody here in light of those teachings that wants to sign up for observing the Sabbath today? Let's hope we have the wisdom and proper understanding to not want to do that. So the Sabbath law has been taken out of the way. We're not under that anymore as we are under the law of Christ. This morning, if there's anybody that is present that needs to obey the gospel of Christ, to do the things that we just saw in Colossians chapter 2, in verses 10 through 13, that is, partake of that circumcision of Christ, that cutting off of the body of sin. That's what repentance is. Have you done that? Are you ready to cut off that body of sin and no longer follow those sinful ways that you've lived your life in before up until now? Are you ready now to be buried with Christ in baptism so that you can have your sins forgiven and then follow Christ in his teachings? Well, this is an opportunity for you to do that this morning, and we're encouraging you to do that right now if that is your need, or if you are a Christian and if you need to repent of sin, or if you need the prayers of the church at this time, you have this opportunity also. Anyone that needs to come right now, please do so while we stand and sing.